Good morning. It's Wednesday, October 30th. I'm Shamita Basu. This is Apple News Today. On today's show, the issues that matter to first-time voters. The Taliban strips more rights away from women in Afghanistan. And why you might need to rethink your Halloween costume. But first, Vice President Kamala Harris delivered a speech last night that her campaign billed as her closing arguments to a crowd of tens of thousands of voters. She spoke at the Ellipse in Washington, D.C., where nearly 4 years ago, former President Trump urged a crowd of his supporters to march to the Capitol, where they started a deadly riot. With the White House visible behind her, Harris described Trump as unstable and obsessed with revenge.
He is the person who stood at this very spot nearly 4 years ago and sent an armed mob to the United States Capitol to overturn the will of the people in a free and fair election.
And she said that she understands the gravity of the role of president, and Trump does not.
This election is more than just a choice between two parties and two different candidates. It is a choice about whether we have a country rooted in freedom for every American or ruled by chaos and division.
Harris also hit on a range of policy issues, from price gouging at grocery stores to the cost of childcare and abortion rights. Now, the polls currently have Harris and Donald Trump neck and neck. If she wins, it would be historic, not just because she would become our first woman president, but because of how short her campaign has been. Remember, she only entered the race 101 days ago and has, in a matter of weeks, organized a massive coalition of supporters, outraised Trump 3-1, and signed up hundreds of thousands of volunteers. And she has the support of several high-profile Republicans, from Liz Cheney to, most recently, Barbara Bush, daughter of George W. Bush. To take stock of it all, I spoke with The New Yorker's Evan Osnos, who has a long piece out in the magazine about Harris's whirlwind campaign. And I started by asking Evan about the significance of the location of Harris's speech.
Well, that is a pretty poignant place to be, pretty powerful in some ways, I think unsettling for some people. In this case, Kamala Harris's campaign clearly intended the location to evoke the memory of how awful that was and how it felt for Americans to see that kind of radical insult to our sense of peaceful politics in this country, and to remind people in the most visceral way possible of what a Trump presidency felt like. That moment, this closing moment of a campaign, is very difficult, especially for the Harris campaign, precisely because it has to span this incredibly vast constituency. At one point, somebody described it to me quite well as it runs from Cheney to Chomsky. And somehow you have to have a speech that can speak to all of these different interests and preoccupations and priorities, which is very different than what Donald Trump does, in which he essentially has one unchanging message for the people who are most devoted to him.
And to that point, I mean, what a difficult thing to do, right? To try to address all of these different interests, all of these different people that you're trying to pull into your party. I mean, Harris, it seems to me, is really trying to do a lot of things in this last week before Election Day, deliver a forward-looking message, an economic-focused message, but also really, notably, moving from the sort of joyful warrior stance that she took on early in her campaign to a much more somber and even urgent messenger. What do you make of this shift we've seen happen over the course of her campaign?
Yeah. Well, the reality is, no matter what she does, she gets criticized from one side or another. This is partly the reality of politics, but it's also a measure of how dire this feels for Democrats, this sense that the Democrats really don't imagine that this is an election that they can afford to lose, that the country can afford to lose. And so when she gets too focused on questions of democracy, then inevitably there are some Democrats who stand up and say, hold on, that's a a kind of privileged issue. They say that's not the kind of thing that your average person is talking about at the dinner table. And then on the other side, if she focuses entirely on grocery prices and the cost of prescription drugs, then there are some people who say you're abdicating the significance, the gravity of this moment. We've never had a presidential candidate like Donald Trump who is threatening basic norms of democracy. And so she has to find a way to tack between the two. And I will say it would be hard for any politician. It's especially uncomfortable for her because so much of her career has been about this very directed form of inquiry, being a prosecutor, looking at specific facts and then litigating them in the moment, rather than these kinds of capacious speeches where you step back and go for philosophical reach. So it's hard.
You spent some time in your latest New Yorker piece really focusing on Harris's bio and going back some years. What do you think voters should know about her and who she was before she became the presidential nominee, certainly, but even before she became vice president?
Well, I think it is really easy to forget just how amazing it actually is, how dramatically different it is to have a presidential nominee who is the daughter of two immigrants. We've never had that before. Much less the fact that she is a woman, that she is a woman of color, that she is would be the first Black woman, the first South Asian woman. You know, all of this is significant. She grew up in a family in which she had these two intense and highly educated parents, her mother, Shyamala Gopalan, who came from India, her father, Donald Harris, who was this brilliant economic student from Jamaica. And they both, in their own ways, raised her to believe very confidently in herself. It was this kind of, in a sense, a sort of critical love for this country, a belief that the United States was something worth leading, and at the same time, a belief that it was worth criticizing. And it was that combination of qualities that was the intellectual atmosphere she grew up in.
You know, it can be said that it always takes some time to understand truly what an election was all about. And I don't just mean tallying the votes and understanding who won, but I mean reflecting back on what that moment meant in our country. What do you think history will say about what this presidential race was all about?
I think probably we will come to see this election as a moment when people had to decide whether this country was fundamentally trying to reconstruct an idea of itself from the past, which never entirely existed in the way that the nostalgia suggests, what Donald Trump talks about when he says, make America great again, or whether Americans are prepared to say, no, we're going to forge into a different era. And what so much of her career has been about is the idea that actually this country has been on this long, steady, halting, zigzagging process of trying to turn outsiders into insiders and expand the perimeter of power. She herself is a demonstration of that. And I think that's what this election is about.
Evan Osnos for The New Yorker. Thank you so much. I appreciate your time.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Let's turn now to America's youngest voters and how they're thinking about the election. The publication Chalkbeat, along with the New York Times, has been surveying a group of roughly 1,000 young voters over the course of the year. Many of them are voting for the first time. Editor Caroline Bauman told us affordability and the economy more generally was a primary concern they heard from many young voters, like Owen from Salt Lake City, who just graduated from high school. He works as an automotive technician at a Ford dealership in the area.
He said that was his number one issue. You know, some direct quotes from Owen: I pay so much for gas, I pay so much for food, I can't move out of my parents' house because rent here is a minimum of $1,500 typically. I'd like the tax on gas heavily reduced.
Bauman also told us about Annabelle from Chicago. She's a student at Michigan State University.
Annabelle talked to us about gun violence and her experience, a personal experience in high school when she was at a mall and there was an active shooter, and just the trauma and the fear associated with living through something like that. And then, of course, now at Michigan State, where a campus shooting occurred in recent history. So for her, this is very top of mind.
Emily is a freshman at Vanderbilt University in Nashville. She grew up in the Bronx. She's always loved reading, and she told Chalkbeat her top issue is protecting books for future generations.
What she told us is that for her, as a Black woman, the issue is book banning, the banning of African American courses and the potential erasure of Black history in public schools and college courses as well. And, you know, she cited that AP African American Studies classes have already been banned in Florida and how concerning that is for her. And so, you know, this is not necessarily an issue that I think people credit students with following.
Bauman got to spend time talking with these young people over many months, and she says she was impressed by how deeply they're thinking about this election and the range of issues that matter to them. And they could potentially be a very impactful demographic in what's expected to be a historically close election. In 2020, 50% of eligible voters between the ages of 18 and 29 voted, the third highest turnout in decades. This year, a slightly higher percentage say they plan to vote. Before we let you go, a few other stories being featured in the Apple News app. The man who attacked Nancy Pelosi's husband has been sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole. David DePapp was found guilty in June on charges related to his attack on Paul Pelosi, who was 82 years old at the time. The attack took place just before the 2022 midterm elections. Paul Pelosi suffered head wounds, including a skull fracture that required plates and screws to repair. DePapp admitted during his trial that Nancy Pelosi was the intended target, but she wasn't home at the time. Here's how the former Speaker of the House described the experience on CNN a year ago.
For me, this is really the hard part because Paul was not the target, and he's the one who's paying the price. It's really sad because it is a flame that was fueled by misinformation and all the rest of that, which is most unfortunate.
The San Francisco Chronicle reports DePapp used his final statement before being sentenced to read off a number of conspiracy theories. He did not apologize to the Pelosis. Following the sentencing, the Pelosi family said justice had been served. In international news, the Taliban in Afghanistan has announced women are now banned from hearing each other's voices. Afghan human rights experts say it amounts to banning women from having conversations with each other. It comes after the Taliban already ordered women to cover their faces, to not speak with men besides their husbands or close relatives, and to speak quietly even inside their own homes so their voices can't be heard from outside. One activist said in response to the latest measure, how are women who are the sole providers for their families supposed to buy bread, seek medical care, or simply exist? Women who defy the rules can be arrested and sent to prison. And finally, something very spooky is going on this Halloween, unseasonably warm temperatures. The Washington Post reports that areas in the Midwest, South, and on the East Coast will be dealing with summer-like weather on Thursday. In places like Philadelphia and D.C., highs are expected to be around or above 80 degrees. Now, I was going to dress my baby up as a chef with a little chef's hat and everything, but we might have to leave the onesie at home and let him be the naked chef. You can find all these stories and more in the Apple News app. And if you're already listening in the news app right now, we've got a narrated article coming up next. Bloomberg Businessweek reports that thousands of asylum seekers are being held in former jails turned detention centers indefinitely. And while the Biden campaign once vowed to close these privately operated centers, the administration still relies on them. If you're listening in the podcast app, follow Apple News Plus Narrated to find that story. And I'll be back with the news tomorrow.